This is your reader, Caroline, and this week I will be sharing stories and tales with a bent toward the natural world. In the words of Stephen Sondheim, we are heading into the woods. So my first story is a fairy tale by the Brothers Grimm. When the story begins, nature has become an enemy. No one dares go into the woods. A case of culture, the kingdom, versus fear of the natural world, the woods. It is the king's son who will ultimately heal this rift. 21st century man faces the same conflicts. As modern man hastens climate issues or tries to control nature through our use of pesticides and poisons, written over 100 years ago, here is the Brothers Grimm, Iron John. There was once on a time a king who had a great forest near his palace, full of all kinds of wild animals. One day, he sent out a huntsman to shoot him a roe, but he did not come back. "Oh, perhaps some accident has fallen him," said the king. And the next day, he sent out two more huntsmen who were to search for him, but they too stayed away. Then, on the third day, he sent for all his huntsmen and said, "Scour the whole forest through and do not give up until ye have found all three." But of these also, none came home again. And of the pack of hounds which they had taken with them, none were seen more. From that time forth, no one would any longer venture into the forest, and it lay there in deep stillness and solitude, and nothing was seen of it, but sometimes an eagle or a hawk flying over it. This lasted for many years, when a strange huntsman announced himself to the king as seeking a situation and offered to go into the dangerous forest. The king, however, would not give his consent and said, "It is not safe in there. I fear it would fare with thee no better than with the others, and thou wouldst never come out again." The huntsman replied, "Lord, I will venture it at my own risk. Of fear I know nothing." The huntsman therefore betook himself with his dog to the forest. It was not long before the dog fell in with some game on the way and wanted to pursue it, but hardly had the dog run two steps when it stood before a deep pool, could go no farther, and a naked arm stretched itself out of the water, seized it, and drew it under. When the huntsman saw that, he went back and fetched three men to come with buckets and bail out the water. When they could see to the bottom, there lay a wild man whose body was brown like rusty iron and whose hair hung over his face down to his knees. They bound him with cords and led him away to the castle. There was great astonishment over the wild man. The king, however, had him put in an iron cage in his courtyard and forbade the door to be opened on pain of death. And the queen herself was to take the key into her keeping. And from this time forth, every one could again go into the forest with safety. Now, the king had a son of 8 years who was once playing in the courtyard, and while he was playing, his golden ball fell into the cage. The boy ran thither and said, "Give me my ball out." "Not till thou hast opened the door for me," answered the man. "No," said the boy, "I will not do that. The king has forbidden it," and ran away. The next day, he again went and asked for his ball. The wild man said, "Open my door." But the boy would not. On the third day, the king had ridden out hunting, and the boy went once more and said, I cannot open the door, even if I wished, for I have not the key. Then the wild man said, It lies under thy mother's pillow. Thou canst get it there. The boy, who wanted to have his ball back, cast all thought to the winds and brought the key. The door opened with difficulty, and the boy pinched his fingers. When it was open, the wild man stepped out, gave him the golden ball, and hurried away. The boy had become afraid. He called and cried after him, Oh, wild man, do not go away, or I shall be beaten. The wild man turned back, took him up, set him on his shoulder, and went with hasty steps into the forest. When the king came home, he observed the empty cage and asked the queen how that had happened. She knew nothing about it and sought the key, but it was gone. She called the boy, but no one answered. The king set out people to seek for him in the fields, but they did not find him. Then he could easily guess what had happened, and much grief reigned in the royal court. Well, when the wild man had once more reached the dark forest, he took the boy down from his shoulder and said to him, Thou wilt never see thy father and mother again, but I will keep thee with me, for thou hast set me free, and I have compassion on thee. If thou dost all I bid thee, thou shalt fare well. Of treasure and gold have I enough, and more than anyone in the world. He made a bed of moss for the boy on which he slept, and the next morning the man took him to a well and said, Behold, the gold well is as bright and clear as crystal. Thou shalt sit beside it, and take care that nothing falls into it, or it will be polluted. I will come every evening to see if thou hast obeyed my order. The boy placed himself by the margin of the well, and often saw a golden fish or a golden snake show itself therein, and took care that nothing fell in. As he was thus sitting, his finger hurt him so violently that he involuntarily put it in the water. He drew it quickly out again, but saw that it was quite gilded. And whatsoever pains he took to wash the gold off again, all was to no purpose. In the evening, Iron John came back, looked at the boy, and said, What has happened to the well? Nothing, he answered, and held his finger behind his back, that the man might not see it. But he said, Thou hast dipped thy finger into the water. This time it may pass, but take care thou dost not again let anything go in. By daybreak, the boy was already sitting by the well and watching it. His finger hurt him again, and he passed it over his head. And then, unhappily, a hare fell down into the well. He took it quickly out, but it was already quite gilded. Iron John came and already knew what had happened. Thou hast let a hare fall into the well, said he. I will allow thee to watch by it once more. But if this happens for the third time, then the well is polluted, and thou canst no longer remain with me. Well, on the third day, the boy sat by the well and did not stir his finger, however much it hurt him. But the time was long to him, and he looked at the reflection of his face on the surface of the water, and as he still bent down more and more while he was trying to do so and trying to look straight into the eyes, his long hair fell down from his shoulders into the water. He raised himself up quickly, but the whole of the hair of his head was already golden and shone like the sun. Oh, you may imagine how terrified the poor boy was. He took his pocket handkerchief and tied it round his head in order that the man might not see it. When he came, he already knew everything and said, "Take the handkerchief off." Then the golden hair streamed forth, and let the boy excuse himself as he might, it was of no use. "Thou hast not stood the trial, and canst stay here no longer. Go forth into the world. There thou wilt learn what poverty is. But as thou hast not a bad heart, and as I mean well by thee, there is one thing I will grant thee. If thou fallest into any difficulty, come to the forest and cry, 'Iron John,' and then I will come and help thee. My power is great, greater than thou thinkest, and I have gold and silver in abundance." Then the king's son left the forest and walked by beaten and unbeaten paths, ever onwards, until at length he reached a great city. There he looked for work, but could find none, and he had learnt nothing by which he could help himself. At length he went to the palace and asked if they would take him in. The people about court did not at all know what use they could make of him, but they liked him and told him to stay. At length the cook took him into his service and said he might carry wood and water and rake the cinders together. Once when it so happened that no one else was at hand, the cook ordered him to carry the food to the royal table. But as he did not like to let his golden hair be seen, he kept his little cap on. Such a thing as that had never yet come under the king's notice, and he said, "When thou comest to the royal table, thou must take thy hat off." He answered, "Ah, Lord, I cannot. I have a bad sore place on my head." Then the king had the cook called before him and scolded him and asked how he could take such a boy as that into his service, and that he was to turn him off at once. The cook, however, had pity on him and exchanged him for the gardener's boy. And now the boy had to plant and water the garden, hoe and dig and bear the wind and bad weather. Once in summer, when he was working alone in the garden, the day was so warm he took his little cap off that the air might cool him. As the sun shone on his hair, it glittered and flashed so that the rays fell into the bedroom of the king's daughter, and up she sprang to see what that could be. Then she saw the boy and cried to him, "Boy, bring me a wreath of flowers." He put his cap on with all haste and gathered wild field flowers and bound them together. When he was ascending the stairs with them, the gardener met him and said, "How canst thou take the king's daughter a garland of such common flowers? Go quickly, get another, and seek out the prettiest and rarest." "Oh, no," replied the boy, "the wild ones have more scent and will please her better." When he got into the room, the king's daughter said, "Take thy cap off. It is not seemly to keep it on in my presence." He again said, I may not. I have a sore head." She, however, caught at his cap and pulled it off, and then his golden hair rolled down on his shoulders, and it was splendid to behold. He wanted to run out, but she held him by the arm and gave him a handful of money. With these he departed, but he cared not for the gold pieces. He took them to the gardener and said, "I present them to thy children. They can play with them." The following day the king's daughter again called to him that he was to bring her a wreath of field flowers, and when he went in with it, she instantly snatched at his cap and wanted to take it away from him, but he held it fast with both hands. She again gave him a handful of money, but he would not keep them, and he gave them to the gardener for playthings for his children. On the third day, things went just the same. She could not get his cap away from him, and he would not have her money. Not long afterwards, the country was overrun by war. The king gathered together his people and did not know whether or not he could offer any opposition to the enemy, who was superior in strength and had a mighty army. Then said the gardener's boy, "I am grown up and will go to the wars also, only give me a horse." The others laughed and said, "Seek one for thyself when we are gone. We will leave one behind us in the stable for thee." When they had gone forth, he went into the stable and got the horse out. It was lame of one foot and limped, hobbledy-jig, hobbledy-jig. Nevertheless, he mounted it and rode away to the dark forest. When he came to the outskirts, he called, "Iron John!" 3 times so loudly that it echoed through the trees. Thereupon the wild man appeared immediately and said, "What dost thou desire?" "I want a strong steed, for I am going to the wars." "That thou shalt have, and still more than thou askest for." Then the wild man went back into the forest, and it was not long before a stable boy came out of it, who led a horse that snorted with its nostrils and could hardly be restrained. And behind them followed a great troop of soldiers entirely equipped in iron, and their swords flashed in the sun. The youth made over his 3-legged horse to the stable boy, mounted the other, and rode at the head of the soldiers. When he got near the battlefield, a great part of the king's men had already fallen, and little was wanting to make the rest give way. Then the youth galloped hither with his iron soldiers, broke like a hurricane over the enemy, and beat down all who opposed them. They began to fly, but the youth pursued and never stopped until there was not a single man left. Instead, however, of returning to the king, he conducted his troop by byways back to the forest and called forth Iron John. "What dost thou desire?" asked the wild man. "Take back thy horse and thy troops, and give me my 3-legged horse again." All that he asked was done, and soon he was riding on his 3-legged horse. When the king returned to his palace, his daughter went over to meet him and wished him joy of victory. "I am not the one who carried away the victory," said he, "but a strange knight who came to my assistance with his soldiers." The daughter wanted to hear who the strange knight was, but the king did not know and said, "He followed the enemy, and I did not see him again." She inquired of the gardener where his boy was, but he smiled and said, "He has just come home on his 3-legged horse, and the others have been mocking him and crying, 'Here comes our hobbledy-jig back again.'" They asked, too, "Under what hedge hast thou been lying sleeping all the time?" He, however, said, "I did the best of all, and it would have gone badly without me." And then he was still more ridiculed. The king said to his daughter, "I will proclaim a great feast that shall last for 3 days, and thou shalt throw a golden apple. Perhaps the unknown will come to it." When the feast was announced, the youth went into the forest and called Iron John. "What dost thou desire?" asked he. "That I may catch the king's daughter's golden apple." "It is as safe as if thou hadst already," said Iron John. "Thou shalt likewise have a suit of red armor for the occasion and ride on a spirited chestnut horse." When the day came, the youth galloped to the spot, took his place among the knights, and was recognized by no one. The king's daughter came forward and threw a golden apple to the knights, but none of them caught it but he. Only as soon as he had it, he galloped away. On the second day, Iron John equipped him as a white knight and gave him a white horse. Again, he was the only one who caught the apple, and he did not linger an instant, but galloped off with it. The king grew angry and said, "That is not allowed. He must appear before me and tell his name." He gave the order that if the knight who caught the apple should go away again, they should pursue him, and if he would not come back willingly, they were to cut him down and stab him. On the third day, He received from Iron John a suit of black armor and a black horse, and again he caught the apple. But when he was riding off with it, the king's attendants pursued him, and one of them got so near him that he wounded the youth's leg with the point of his sword. The youth, nevertheless, escaped from them, but his horse leapt so violently that the helmet fell from the youth's head, and they could see that he had golden hair. They rode back and announced this to the king. The following day, the king's daughter asked the gardener about his boy. "He is at work in the garden. The queer creature has been at the festival, too, and only came home yesterday evening. He has likewise shown my children 3 golden apples, which he has won." The king had him summoned into his presence, and he came and again had his little cap on his head. But the king's daughter went up to him and took it off, and then his golden hair fell down over his shoulders. And he was so handsome, they were all amazed. "Art thou the knight who came every day to the festival, always in different colors, and who caught the 3 golden apples?" asked the king. "Yes," answered he, "and here the apples are." And he took them out of his pocket and returned them to the king. "If you desire further proof, you may see the wound which your people gave me when they followed me, but I am likewise the knight who helped you to your victory over your enemies. If thou canst perform such deeds as that, thou art no gardener's boy. Tell me, who is thy father?" "My father is a mighty king, and gold have I in plenty, as great as I require." "I well see," said the king, "then that I owe thee thanks. Can I do anything to please thee?" "Yes," answered he, "that indeed you can. Give me your daughter to wife." The maiden laughed and said, "He does not stand much on ceremony, but I have already seen by his golden hair that he was no gardener's boy." And then she went and kissed him. His father and mother came to the wedding and were in great delight, for they had given up all hope of ever seeing their dear son again. And as they were sitting at the marriage feast, the music suddenly stopped, the doors opened, and a stately king came in with a great retinue. He went up to the youth, embraced him, and said, "I am Iron John, and was by enchantment a wild man. But thou hast set me free. All the treasures which I possess shall be thy property." When the Irish poet Lewis MacNeice reflected on Woods, he found his own experience very different from his parents. Where his father had hardly in his life walked in the woods, MacNeice knew that woods were a kingdom of time and sky, filled with knights, nymphs, birds, and ghosts. Trees created a world which drew him, man and boy, and on which his imagination drew. Here is the poem Woods by Irish poet Lewis MacNeice. My father, who found the English landscape tame, had hardly in his life walked in a wood. Too old when first he met one. Mallory's knights, Keats nymphs, or the Midsummer's Night Dream could never harass the room where he spelled out true and good, with their interleaving of half-truths and not-quites. While for me, from the age of 10, the socketed wooden gate into a Dorset planting, into a dark but gentle ambush, was an alluring eye. Within was a kingdom free from time and sky, caterpillar webs on the forehead, danger under the feet, and the mind adrift in a floating and rustling ark, packed with birds and ghosts, 2 of every race, trills of love from the picture books. Oh, might I never land but here, grown 6 foot tall. Find me also a love, also out of the picture book, whose hand would be soft as the webs of the wood, and on her face the wood pigeon's voice would shaft a chrism from above. So in a grassy ride, a rain-filled hoof-marked coined by a finger of sun from the mint of long ago, was the last of Lancelot's glitter. Make-believe dies hard. That the rider passed here lately and is a man we know is still untrue. The gate to legend remains unbarred. The grown-up hates of divorce what the child joined. Thus, from a city, when my father would frame escape, he thought, as I do, of bog or rock. But I have also this other, this English choice into what yet is foreign, whatever its name. Each wood is the mystery and the recurring shock of its dark coolness in a foreign voice. Yet in using the word tame, my father was maybe right. These woods are not the forest. Each is moored to a village somewhere near. If not of today, they are not like the wilds of Mayo. They are assured of their place by men, reprieved from the Neolithic night by gameskeepers or by Herrick's girls at play. And always we walk out again. The patch of sky at the end of the path grows and discloses an ordered opening air long ruled by dike and fence, with geese whose form and gait proclaim their consequence. Parketed outposts, windows browed with thatch, and cowpats, and inconsequent wild roses. My next story is from the 20th century American writer Dorothy Baker. She shares the restorative power of the woods in her short story, Summer. A woman stood on a river bridge, leaning her arms on sunlit stone. Behind her in a clearing, a black wooden tea shed and a notice. Teas, minerals, cigarettes. In the clearing, at the edge of the wood, two children gathered blackberries, gravely intent, heads straight with concentration on their slender necks. They picked slowly, without moving, ceremoniously inspecting each fruit before they placed it in the basket. They were little children, dwarfed almost to nothing by wooden hills, descending steeply on every side into a narrow valley. For a few moments, the woman watched them with detachment. They were not her children. She turned her attention to the river. She leaned over the bridge and stared at the water. It was warm and golden and restless, where everything else was deathly still. The woman had pale hair and a pale face, with large blunt features that shone like wax, as though suffering a melting change from heat of the sun. Her eyes, too, were pale, and she wore a stiff apron with a bib, the sort now only worn by country women. Her anxious, ugly face and homely apron, at humble odds with rich woods, brought a kind of backdoor intimacy to the lonely place, a place that should have sheltered none but fairy folk or stolen children, or maybe a prince riding to a castle in the hills. The castle in the hills had long ceased to expect a fairy prince, or indeed a man of any kind. The woman on the bridge knew all about that, a female stronghold, the castle. No man penetrated farther than its grass-green courtyard, tradesman at that, bringing food to Mrs. Thompson and her three daughters, earthly remnants of a butcher from the north. He'd made a good thing out of the last war. Those days, you could make a fortune. There'd been a chance for profits, even for profiteering. Butchering. A castle at the end of it for his womenfolk. He hadn't lived long enough to enjoy it. Time to make a packet, and then goodbye. Still, money hadn't made his daughters marriageable. Three ugly, elderly females and a miserly mother living snug and secure up there. From every window, finest views of England. And they were stuffed round a fire, seeing only pet dogs on the hearth or their own unlikable faces. And she working for them, 9 till 1 every morning before coming to the bridge. Great fat women with rolling R's and clipped E's. Dyed hair. Not folks she respected. They couldn't go out riding in a car any more than other people nowadays. The woman shifted her elbow for ease on the stone and looked again to where the children played. She cried with perfunctory suddenness. "Polly, Sam, don't go too far in." Woods and hills indignantly echoed her words like a religious meeting profaned by an unbeliever. Echo bestirred itself to protest. Polly's blue dress startled back onto green grass. The little boy followed. His voice excited and friendly, he shouted, "We seen a rabbit just here." He didn't expect any reply, but he went on shouting, "We got some blackberries, big ones." The little girl looked silent and smiling toward the bridge. She was too young to shout sentences. Their guardian didn't seem to hear or see them. She continued to stare at the water, the way it moved, the transparent amber color it took from yellow boulders, held her there. In spite of its urge to be gone, it was more soothing than the hills that swung narrow paths down to the valley till your head turned giddy with looping twists of downwardness. To come here 6 afternoons only to stare at water. 10 years without ever considering it except as a tourist attraction or for washing up. 6 days, and she watching the river till she knew every trick by which it took the boulders, every bough that bent and stroked its surface. 6 days, and none but woodcutters going through the valley on their way home. They brought their tea with them. She saw them swinging blue empty cans as they descended the paths, smoking and talking together, and a nod for her as they passed the hut. A silent woman, a nod was all she expected. Woodcutters' work didn't depend on people. Trees were there, waiting to be cut down. A shame the way they fell, the lovely things. There'd be none left by the end of the war. To grow like that for patient years, and then laid low in a single afternoon. The same with the business. Grown and flourishing, now cut off by war. All the blessed summer you could count the customers on your two hands. Nobody knew when the war would end. As many opinions about that as there were tongues to utter them. It all depended on how hard they were hit and what they believed. Maybe you could trust old Moore, but he wrapped things up so. Still, her brother swore by him, and he was shrewd enough. She slipped her hand into her apron pocket and took out old Moore's almanac. Eyes screwed in concentration, she turned pages slowly, looking for the place. According to old Moore, the war might be over next autumn. 1 year and more to get through. The rent of the hut still going on. Another winter after the war had finished before her trade could look up. Then spring for folks to settle down to peaceful ways again. And by summer, maybe, on the roads in search of tea and beauty spots. not that she really believed things would be as good as before. Sunshine, fine weather, made you sad for times that were gone. She wasn't looking forward all that eagerly. The good days they'd seen, her three helpers in the rush season, the kettle boiling for dear life, no sooner emptied than filled and on again, plates of ham, cakes, and she ordering it all, as busy as a body could wish. Time she felt almost merry. Hard work? Who minded, with money going into your pocket and customers in rows on the benches? It took townsfolk for spending and talking. The more they went on, the more they ate and drank to strengthen themselves. They could never finish about the view. They praised it till she puffed with possessive pride in hills and woods and water, wild daffodils in spring and heather purpling the summer. The view had made the trade. She'd never bothered about it much, growing up with it, not till these last few weeks. And now she watched the river with forlorn affection, grieving over their shared desertion. What was the good of scenery without folks to admire it and take a little refreshment? 4 years, near enough, the war had gone on, and visitors were getting fewer and fewer, scraping the rent together. Daren't let the place go. Others would get in first, offering more money for the business she and her brother had built up. Foolish of him to marry, especially that feeble creature. Till then, they'd been well enough together. And now 4 children in the little cottage. And she going back to cleaning, after tasting independence and being your own master. Dyed hair and ugliness, too fat to stir. Pay somebody else to stir for them. And little enough pay at that. She folded old more and pushed it back into her pocket. If it told the truth, things weren't too bad. Hold on for 2 winters. Thinking of her brother, she looked for the children. She called out with automatic suddenness, "Polly, Sam, don't go too far in." The children were lost in play, and their aunt's words came flatly through the sunshine. No more than call of bird or droning of insect or familiar murmur of water. The woman was too absorbed, too tired and dispirited to repeat her cry. She struggled with thought like a fly in a web, and freeing herself one way came back to the snare of the river. 6 days, and no one to ask a cup of tea. 6 days of mellow golden weather, woods at their best. Sometimes a buzzard hovering in the still air, sometimes a kingfisher darting. That had been a star turn in good days. At last, she moved from the bridge. Teas, minerals, cigarettes. She read the sign outside the tea shed with a touch of old pride. 10 shillings to have it painted. Leaving the sun-soaked road, she went into the dark shed, into the back room where she kept her stores. She opened cupboards aimlessly, rows of empty shelves, cups hanging on hooks, spoons in a box, and a solitary cake made a week ago in case of customers. She might light a fire and put the kettle on. Supposing she were to make tea, the fragrant smell curling among the trees might tempt somebody down to her. Would it be inviting bad luck? She hesitated between superstition and wishing. Then she went out and collected sticks, drew them together on the bit of hard earth behind the shed, and kindled them. The fire smoked, crackled, burst into thin flames, scarcely visible in sunshine. She hung the great black kettle on the tripod. She took down dusty cups and saucers and arranged them on the trestle tables. When she laid out every cup and saucer, the place looked busy, as though waiting for a crowd. The sight of so many cups peopled in the valley with memories. Hoot of horn, stealthy sound of cars on soft earth, singing and shouts of children among trees, lovers holding hands by the river. The fire burned with a sweet wood smell, and while she moved from table to table with an illusion of old importance, the kettle began to sing. She fetched the cake from the cupboard. Oh, it would have been nice to have one for each table. She set it on the table nearest the road, warmed the teapot, and went back to the bridge. She looked along the valley road as far as her sharp eyes could see, and there was no one. She returned to the hut and made the tea, then poured herself a cup. It was fresh and comforting, and wood smoke blended with the tea's scented flavor. She sat for a long time, crouched at the table by the road. She might as well call the children and give them a piece of cake. Nobody else seemed to want it. She shouted to her nephew and niece, but they did not answer. They had gone too far into the woods. She looked round the hut at the cups and saucers mutely shining there. It had been a good cup. Nothing now to do but put things back. She wasn't inclined to do that. She walked out of the hut with a backward glance. She had forgotten the children. All her worries yielded to a trance-like pleasure. The tea and the hot sun made her features more meltingly waxen than ever. She began to walk along the river towards a bald and conical hill. The woods and heights soared round her, and she a piebald speck in the narrow valley. The woods and hills were unstable, in danger of falling. She alone remained firm. She touched the swelling toad flax, growing sturdily, stems thrust first outward, then upward from the boulders by the river. She smelt the late honeysuckle, tangled high in briars. Every sound, every smell was sharp and sweet. When she had walked for some time, she remembered the hut, as though it were a place far off in time as well as space. She looked back. The place was lost to sight. If she returned there, there would be cups to put away, children to find, the tea shed to lock, and the drag back to the village. She never wanted to do these things again. Her brother's house, her brother's children, her brother's wife, and not a sixpence taken. She intended to go a long way. She pushed her way through difficult places, slopped over marshy ground. But when she had gone round the foot of the bald hill back into the woods again, and it was good to be with trees, she began to feel tired. She sat down by the river, thinking only of sleep. As far as she had come, the river was amber with golden stones and yellow boulders. Willow and mountain ash grew here, darkening the water with splashes of shadow. Little currents and eddies were drawn out from the boulders, wavering into fine black lines, like bars for river music. The longer she looked at the water, the deeper she seemed to sink into herself, as though that self were now seized by the strong arms of the river and pushed into cool and secret places. In spite of sun, on the bank it was chilly. Trees made earth cold, cold as a tomb. She wanted to escape the coldness of the earth, the calculations of seasons and times. She wanted to go away from hills, twisting their paths above her like screws of anxiety turning in her head. She thought of ways to escape. She knelt at the river's edge and bent to see the woman reflected there. Moist features, broad, folded arms, hair straggled and bunned, and the water breaking up furrows of care into a delicate movement. Not so ugly after all, not fat and dyed and rattled like some she knew. The river split care, cut it into pieces of watery color, covered it with a cloth of clear gold. With one hand grasping the grasses at the edge, she leaned far over the water. Her image was already captive, a promise of surrender. Hills and trees and water whirled in fearful invitation. She knelt rigid and cold on the bank, waiting. Then hope, like a patient stream revived, fed her with reckonings of seasons and times, steadied the hills and warmed her to reality. 2 more winters. 4 already gone through, hold on somehow. The summer afternoon, divided into duties and anxieties, cups to put back, hut to lock, children to find, just go on. But her body was rooted to earth. She was too tired yet to move. Remembering only sleep, warm, golden sleep, she stretched out on the broad grasses, deep and dark and protective. Sleep covered her, held her in forgetfulness till stars came out, and she woke, thinking of children. The children played in the woods. They heard their aunt's sharp cry from time to time. Then, until sunset, nothing. They pretended to be rabbits, the little boy showing his sister how to jump and how to burrow. When he felt tired, he emptied the blackberries onto the turf and counted out 10 for his sister and 10 for himself and put them in the basket. The rest he left on the grass. When he had done this, they went to find their aunt. They stood in the doorway of the hut and saw cups and saucers on every table, ready for a party, and the cake cut in slices. The little boy was puzzled. It was late, and he couldn't see his aunt anywhere. She was not in the yard with the kettle. She was not getting water from the river. The sun was red and the woods dark. He stood waiting, not knowing what to do. At last, he chose 2 pieces of cake and gave one of them to his sister. Taking the little girl's hand, he began to walk home, up the steep road through the woods. My final and maybe my favorite story today is from a Finnish writer, Tove Jansson. In this short story, the forest allows 2 young boys a place to let their imaginations run wild and have a summer of adventure inspired by the story of Tarzan. The Forest by Tove Jansson. In those days, there was nothing but cow's paths through the forest, which was so big that if you went looking for berries, you could get lost and not find your way home again for days. We didn't dare go more than a little way in, and even then we would just stand there and listen to the silence for a while before running back. Maddie was more scared than I was. But then he wasn't yet 6 years old. There was a drop-off below the hill, and Mum had given us quite a lecture about that hill before we said goodbye. Mum worked in town so that we could spend our summer at the cottage, which she had rented through an advertisement. She had also hired Anna to make our meals. Now, mostly Anna just wanted to be left in peace. "Go out and play," she'd say. Well, Maddie followed me everywhere, saying, "Wait for me, and what'll we play?" But he was way too little to hang out with. I mean, what are you supposed to do with a little brother? The days were really long. Then one very special day, Mom sent us a parcel, and in the parcel was a book that changed everything. It was called Tarzan of the Apes. Now, of course, Maddie couldn't read yet, but I would read him bits of it from time to time. Mostly, though, I'd take Tarzan with me into a tree. Maddie would stand at the bottom and pester me with questions. "What's happening now? Is Tarzan okay?" Then Mom sent us The Beasts of Tarzan and The Son of Tarzan. Anna said, "What a nice mom you boys have. It's such a shame you lost your poor papa." "He's not lost," Maddie said. "He's big and strong, and he's not afraid of anything, so you watch what you say about him." Later, Maddie announced, that he was Tarzan's son. The summer changed totally, and the biggest change was that we started going into the forest. We discovered that it was a jungle that no one had ever explored, and we ventured in farther and farther to where the trees crowded together in perpetual twilight. We had to learn to tread silently like Tarzan so as to not crack the smallest twig, and we learned to listen a new way. I explained that for the first time, we couldn't use cow paths because the jungle beast used them to reach their watering holes. I told Maddie we had to be a bit careful with our wild friends, at least for now. "All right, Tarzan," said Maddie. I taught him how to tell directions by the sun so we could find our way home, and I explained we must never set out in cloudy weather. My son became braver and more skillful, but he never quite overcame his fear of deadly ants. Sometimes we lay on our backs in the moss in some safe place and gazed up into a mighty world of green. We hardly ever caught a glimpse of the sky, although the forest bore the sky on its roof. And although we could hear the wind moving through the treetops, the air was utterly still. There was never any danger because the jungle concealed and protected us. One time, we came to a stream. Tarzan's son knew the stream was full of piranhas, but he waded across it all the same very quickly. I was proud of him, perhaps never more so than the time he ventured a little way into deep water, all by himself. I was standing behind a rock holding a safety line, but he didn't know that. I made us bows and arrows, but we shot only one or two hyenas. I mean, we didn't really count them among our wild friends. Oh, and once a boa constrictor. We hit it right in the mouth and it died instantly. When we came home to eat, Anna asked what we'd been playing, and my son told her that we were much too old to play. We were exploring the jungle. "That's nice," said Anna. "You go right ahead, but do try not to be late for supper." We discovered a new independence and followed only the law of the jungle, which can never be questioned and is strict and just. And the jungle opened its arms and accepted us. Each day we had the heady experience of daring, of stretching our limits to the utmost, of being stronger than we dream. But we never killed anything smaller than ourselves. August arrived with its black nights. When the sun cast its red lights between the tree trunks, we would run home because we didn't want to see the darkness fall. Then when Anna had turned off the lamp and closed the kitchen door, we would lie in bed and listen. Something howled a long way off. Then a hooting close to the cottage. "Tarzan," Maddie whispered. "Did you hear that?" "Sleep," I said. "Nothing can get in. Trust me, son." But suddenly I knew with a terrible certainty that my wild friends were friends no longer. I caught the rank smell of wild beasts rubbing their hairy bodies against the wall of the cottage. It was I who had conjured them, and only I could send them away before it was too late.
"Papa," Maddie cried, "they're coming in."
"Don't be silly," I said. "It's only some old owls and foxes making a noise. Now go to sleep." All that stuff about the jungle was something we made up. It isn't true.
"Of course it's true," Maddie shrieked. "You're wrong. They're real."
He'd worked himself up into a real state. The next summer,
Maddie wanted us to go into the jungle again. But to be honest, that would just have been leading him on. I'm going to end today with a poem by Rudyard Kipling, The Way Through the Woods. They shut the road through the woods 70 years ago. Weather and rain have undone it again, and now you would never know there was once a road through the woods before they planted the trees. It is underneath the coppice and heath and the thin anemones. Only the keeper sees that where the ring dove broods and the badgers roll at ease, there was once a road through the wood. Yet, if you enter the woods of a summer evening late, when the night air cools on the trout-ringed pools, where the otter whistles his mate, they fear not men in the woods because they see so few. You will hear the beat of a horse's feet and the swish of a skirt in the dew, steadily cantering through the misty solitudes, as though they perfectly knew the old lost road through the woods. But there is no road through the woods. Thanks for listening. This is your reader, Caroline, wishing you your own good adventures.